do want to wish all of the fathers here a happy Father's Day. I got peach cobbler, but I got it early. So I figured that my Father's Day started out really well. Sometimes God has been referred to as the great architect. And I think that's not a bad way to think about things, because if you really start to look, God has organized everything. Everything that there is has been organized by God. I have never understood how a scientist, an astrophysicist, or somebody that's knowledgeable in biology or any of these things, how they could possibly be an atheist. Because when they're describing the things that are in their field of expertise, they cannot help but use words like design and engineered, because everything so obviously has been. It's designed, it's engineered for its purpose, and as long as people don't monkey with the purpose, then it does its job extremely, extremely well. One of the problems that we have, though, is people just can't seem to leave well enough alone. If they see something, for some reason, they have to mess with it. They can't just keep their hands off. And that is one of the really big problems that we have these days in our country. God designed the family all the way back in the book of Genesis. God designed the family. In Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, God said, Moses said, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." God had a design for the family, and people just want to tinker with it. And that's been especially true in this country since the 1960s. All of a sudden, women couldn't be happy doing the job that women had been doing for, you know, thousands of years prior to that, an extremely important job, and one that oftentimes is not as well done today as it was then, because people want to change God's plan. There's a principle, it's called Chesterton's Fence, and it's a really neat thing. What it is the illustration is that you're walking along a road and you come to a fence. You've never been here before, you're not familiar with the country, but you come and here's this fence. And do you say, well, this fence is in my way, so I'm going to knock it down and continue on my way? Or are you going to wait and find out why the fence is there? And the idea is, before you start to mess with it, maybe you ought to find out why it's there. There was a preacher, he was a youngster, and I hope he's found another line of work by this time or changed his mind about some things. But he was under the impression that anything that was traditional was bad. If it's tradition, you just need to throw it out and do something else. I mean, it came to the point where if you sit in the same pew, in the same spot, every Sunday, that's wrong. You shouldn't do that. You ought to move and go somewhere else. And I said, well, you know, in some bigger congregations, I can kind of see that as being a good thing. We were visiting at a large congregation one time, and a lady introduced herself to us, and she said, "Are you folks visiting, or do you just normally sit on the other side of the building?" I mean, it was big enough that there were some people there that you would probably never see. But in congregations like this one, that's not an issue. As a matter of fact, having people sit in the same place all the time is a good thing, because if you're not there, people know it. And if you're normally there and suddenly you're not, they get concerned and they want to find out, and they will call you. They'll say, "Where were you? We missed you." So it's a good thing a lot of the time. And the way I had tried to explain it to him was, if you go walking in the woods and you find a path, you're better off staying on the path, because that path is there for a reason. whether it's people or whether it's animals or a combination of the two, it doesn't really matter. Somebody has found that to be the best route to go, and you wander off of that path at your danger. You know, it's your risk if you do it. You know, later on, you become more familiar with the area. Maybe you'll decide that you're going to veer from the path one way or the other. But until then, you better know why it's there. Stay on it. You better find out why the fence is there before you mess with it. And people, when it comes to the family, they have torn down the fence. They have absolutely destroyed the fence. In the bulletin article this morning, I made mention of an economist. They were talking about poverty in the country, and specifically the fact that there are some groups in the country that seem to be below the poverty level more than others. And he was speaking specifically about African American families. He said they find themselves in poverty more than any other group does. And he was counting in Asians, Hispanics, whites, whatever. But African American families find themselves in poverty more than anyone else. And he said a lot of people have all kinds of reasons for this. Most of the time, though, it boils down to they say this is discrimination. It's a holdover from slavery from back in the 1800s, and you know that's why it is. Well, this economist said, well, it's a strange form of racism, if that be the case, because if you look at African American families where the father is present, they are below average in poverty levels. In other words, there are fewer of them that are in the poverty level than other people. He said, so why is it that racism only targets families where the father's not there? Now, what he was talking about, and by the way, the economist's name was Thomas Sowell, if you want to look him up, and he's black, by the way. So it wasn't bigotry or anything that was speaking when he said that. What he illustrated, whether he intended to or not, is the fact that a lot of the problems that we have in this country today are caused by the fact that fathers are not home being fathers. You know, and good for you for staying there and being a father. Fathers are absolutely important. We pay a lot more attention to mothers. You know, you are a lot more likely to get a tearful response to not wishing your mother a good Mother's Day than you are from your father not wishing your father a good Father's Day. You know, fathers have put up with this kind of stuff for a long time. If you forget our birthday, oh, well, we probably forgot it too. If you forget our anniversary, oh, well, we never remember anyway. If you don't wish us a good Father's Day, well, you know, it would have been nice, but whatever. And you do the same thing to the women in the family, and you're going to be in a heap of trouble. Believe me, I've been married long enough to know that. It took me a while. I'm like one guy, if I ever were going to have a tattoo, it would be Marsha's birthday and our anniversary date, and it'd be right there so I could find it. Because I have to start about 2 weeks in advance trying to remember these things. But fathers, oftentimes, we think that they're not really necessary, but they are absolutely necessary. Again, in the passage that was read for us just a moment ago, there in Ephesians chapter 5, beginning in verse 22, Paul said, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord." Now, a lot of women don't like that. Now, the point is, though, is that somebody has to be in charge, and that's true in every single area of life. Like I said, God designed these things, and he designed them the way they are for a reason. Somebody has to be in charge. And if you're talking about the family, if you're talking about the church, if you're talking about a business, if you're talking about the government, I don't care what institution it is, somebody has to be in charge. Somebody has to make the final decisions. Somebody has to take the blame when it goes wrong. And in the case of the family, God has put the father in charge. That does not mean that the wife is a second-class citizen. How many of you have worked for other people and you have somebody that's your boss? Do you consider your boss to be better than you are? No, they've got a position above me. They get the right to tell me what to do, but they're not any better than I am. Do you feel like you're a second-class citizen because there is somebody who gets to tell you what to do at your job? No. So why would you think that in the family? You shouldn't. But he says, wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is head of the wife, as also Christ is head of the church, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, just as the church is subject to Christ, so let the wives be to their own husbands in everything. And a lot of husbands would like to cut it off right there and say, okay, you found your position. Now you need to do whatever I tell you to do from here on out. Nope, don't work that way either. Because he says, husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church and gave himself for her. Husbands are there for the benefit of the wife. Now, in 1 Peter chapter 5, Peter is talking about elders, and he gives them the same type of instruction. He says that elders are not to be masters or not to try to act like masters over the Lord's heritage. Does that mean that elders have no right to make decisions that the congregation should adhere to? Absolutely not. That doesn't mean that at all. Elders have a God-given right, the God-given authority to make decisions for the congregation. They are looking out for the congregation's spiritual well-being. And if they think this is better for the congregation as a whole, then they have the right to make that decision. So the same thing applies to the husband. The husband has the right to make a decision for the family. Now, if he's got a brain in his head, he'll do it after due consultation with his wife. I mean, that just makes sense. Find out what she wants. You know, and if it doesn't matter to you, then do what she wants. The same thing applies to Christians as a whole. You know, prefer others. That's what we're supposed to do. If it doesn't make any real difference one way or the other, if that's the way they want it, then let's go ahead and do it their way. It's not that big a deal. And that's what husbands do for the family. They make the decisions, but again, like I said, they also have to take the blame for them sometimes. Yes, that was what I decided to do, and that did not turn out well. I'm going to try my best to learn a lesson from that and never do it again. And believe me, your wife will remind you of that. Well, you remember the last time you did that? Well, that's a good thing. You know, even Caesar had a slave that would ride along in his chariot with him and remind him that he was mortal so he didn't get too big of a head. Part of what wives are there for, keep us under some kind of control. But we are supposed to be the heads of the family, verse 28 there. So husbands ought to love their own wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as the Lord does the church. So that's why husbands are in charge and what they're supposed to do. They look out for the material well-being of their family. You know, in 1 Timothy chapter 5 and verse 8, Paul said, if anyone does not provide for his own, he's denied the faith, he's worse than an infidel. Now, in that particular context, he's talking about the church supporting widows. But he says that if they have family that could take care of them, then the family needs to take care of them. Because if you're not going to take care of the material needs of your own, you're not worth much. And that's what he says. You have denied the faith. You are worse than an infidel. And to a Christian, that's about one of the worst things you could call them. He says we have an obligation to look out for the material well-being of our families. Now, that does not mean that they have to be filthy rich and have every single solitary little thing their hearts desire. You know, the less you want, the richer you are. There is a lot of truth to that. I remember in a movie, there was a man who owned a lot of territory. He was really rich. And he was having a talk with his daughter that he'd not seen in quite a while. And he was telling her, you know, well, I've got all of this and you're not going to get any of it. You and your brother are not going to get a bit of this. I'm giving it away somewhere else. He said, your mother and I had hard times when we were first married. and we worked through them. We learned a lot by those things, and I want you to have the same advantages I did. So I'm not going to give you anything. You're going to have to go out and work for it. And that's a good thing. Because number one, you learn that, you know, if you're going to go out and work hard, it usually will reward you in one way or another. And number two, you find out that you don't have to have every little thing in life in order to be happy. If you're dependent on happiness on outside things, then you have got a long, hard road to hoe. Because material things can be taken away from you anytime you want. You look at Matthew chapter 7, what Jesus says about material things. And you go down through that list where he's telling people, you know, are you worried about clothes? Look at the lilies of the field. Even Solomon in all his glory wasn't attired like that. But he tells us, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry, don't worry. Having food and raiment therewith, be content. That's what Paul said. But husbands, fathers, are to provide for the material needs of the family, but they are also supposed to provide for the spiritual needs of the family. You know, if you go back into the Old Testament, you find that the father was the head of the family. That was the whole problem with Jacob and Esau. Esau was the older of the two, but he was willing to sell his birthright for a bowl of stew. He did not look at his birthright, his place as the head of the family, as being as important as it was. He was a profane man, the Hebrew writer calls him. But it was an important place. You were the head of the family, and part of what you did was you were in charge of the family, the extended family's religious life as well. You were the one that did the sacrifices for the family. So we are in charge of their spiritual well-being as well. And sadly, these days, most of the time, what you have is you have the mother being the one who's in charge of that. The mothers are the ones who tell their children, you know, come on, you've got to go to Bible study this morning. Get ready. You know, the fathers do sometimes, and more power to you if you are. That's absolutely the right thing to do. But a lot of the time these days, it's the mother that's doing that. Fathers are supposed to be the disciplinarians. Now, whether people like it or not, men and women are different. I remember back, I think it was in the 70s, somebody came out with a book, and they were trying to prove that mentally and emotionally, men and women are not any different. It's just in the way they were raised. And then after about 10 or 12 years, people got tired of that foolishness, and they came out and said, that's the most ridiculous thing anybody has ever said in their life. Men and women are different. It doesn't have to do with the way they are raised. They are just mentally and emotionally hardwired to be different. Generally speaking, and this is a general rule of thumb, there are exceptions to all general rules of thumb, but generally speaking, women are the more emotional of the two. Women are the more nurturing of the two. You know, if a little child falls down and skins their knee, who do they go to? They go to mom. Women are the nurturers. Women are more emotional, but that tends to stand in the way when you're trying to make logical decisions. Men are the more logical of the two. And men will sometimes say, you know, in spite of the fact that this is going to hurt us, it's the right thing to do. It's going to be better for a lot of other people. So that's what we need to do. They will think about these things logically. Women tend to think about them emotionally. And having done so, they can come to different conclusions. And that's one of the reasons why men are supposed to be the head of the house. Now, one of the things that Paul talked about over in 1 Timothy is what women and men are supposed to do. Over in 1 Timothy chapter 2, in verse 11, Paul said, let a woman learn in silence with all submission, and I do not permit a woman to teach or to have authority over a man, but to be in silence. Now, back when I didn't know any better, as most of you know, when I grew up, I was in either a Church of God or a Baptist church of one kind or another, and what I always heard was this was a social thing. It applied to society at that time. It does not apply to society now. And I thought, oh, okay, it was a social thing. And then when a member of the church pointed this out to me and said, well, we don't have women preachers because, you know, Paul said not to. Women were to learn in silence with all submission. I don't permit a woman to teach. I said, oh, that's just a social thing. They said, oh, where does it say that? Never thought of that. I don't know. And then I looked at it, and it said, for Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman being deceived fell into transgression. Okay, so it has nothing to do with society, it's order of creation. Adam was formed first, then Eve was. Eve was deceived by the serpent, Adam wasn't. So that's why men are supposed to be the head of the house. Now, women say, well, that's talking bad about women, saying Eve was deceived. That is not talking bad about women. If anything, it's talking bad about men. Because Adam went into it with his eyes open. Eve was deceived. And you can kind of use that as a little bit of an excuse. I mean, it doesn't excuse what she did by any means. She knew better. But still, at least she was deceived. That's like, well, I did something wrong, but they lied to me. That's why I did it. They lied to me. I was deceived. Or somebody gets you to do something wrong. Yeah, well, I knew it was wrong when I was doing it. You know, who's the one that you would be more likely to forgive right off the top of your head? But the fact of the matter is that Adam is less likely to be deceived by things. So that and order of creation is what puts them in charge of the family. And it doesn't matter if they want to give up that role or not, it's still theirs. It is still theirs. You know, they are the disciplinarians. You know, I said if a child falls and scrapes their knee, who do they go to? They go to their mother. I don't know about you, but back in my early days, if I did something, or if I had ever done anything, which I, of course, obviously never did, that would have rated a spanking, what would my mother have said in the unlikely event that I had ever done anything like that? She would have said, wait till your father gets home. Any of you ever hear that? Boy, that's some of the most dreaded words you could ever hear when you're a child. Wait till your father gets home. You know, I could pretend to cry real loud. Mom would probably let me go. Dad's not going to. You know, oh, hide every belt in the house or every yardstick. If you were to do things like that now, you'd get arrested. I don't notice that it harmed me in any permanent way. But they are the disciplinarians. They have to discipline the family. You know, Proverbs is a great place. Proverbs is a wonderful book, and one of these days we ought to spend some time with it. But Proverbs has a lot of instruction in that. Proverbs 22:15, foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. There was a woman's magazine that I happened to see one time. I won't say who it belonged to. But they had a section in there where people would write letters asking for advice on parenting. And somebody wrote, and they said, I've noticed that my child, if they do something wrong, and I just swat them one time and say, don't do that, then they won't do it. I know you're against, you know, corporal punishment for children. But, you know, it looks like that's the thing that works. Oh, no, 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 you must never spank a child. You're teaching them that getting your way by force is all right. So, no, don't ever do that. And I thought at the time, I need to write them a letter. And I need to ask them, number one, do you have any children? Number two, if you do have children, did you raise them according to the same thing you're teaching other people to do? And if you did, are any of them currently out on parole? Because punishment of a child does not teach the child that you have the right to use force to get your own way. What it teaches a child is that bad behavior has bad consequences. I heard just recently, this is one of those things that just never fails to amaze me. On the news, Nashville News, they were talking about two 12-year-old children, 12 years old. They stole their teacher's car keys off her desk and led the police on a 70-mile chase down Interstate 40. 12-year-old children. And the sorry thing about that is, the really, really sad part is that watch the news. How many times do they tell you a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, a 14-year-old? You know, half of the carjackings in Nashville, and who knows how many there are every night, but they're done on a school night at 2 o'clock in the morning by a 13-year-old. Where's his father? Not there, I can guarantee you that. Heard about one woman, she had 6 children by 5 different fathers. There is something really, really badly wrong with our society. And it's not gonna get any better. Not in the near term. Hopefully it will in the long term. But fathers are there to discipline their children, teach them, no, that is bad, you don't do that. If I had done something silly like that and got caught, you know, some people say, oh boy, we're gonna be in trouble with the teachers, we're gonna be in trouble with the police. I would have said, forget the teachers and the police. What's gonna happen to me when I get home and my dad gets a hold of me? You know, whatever happened to me in school, I'd have got twice as much when I got home, because my father would not put up with that. These days, we'll go and we'll jump on the teacher for punishing the child, not the child. We'll leave them alone. But we have got to discipline our children. Foolishness is bound in the heart of a child, but the rod of correction will drive it far from him. Chasten your son while there is hope, and do not set your heart on his destruction. Proverbs 19:18. And one of the things that fathers need to do is they need to control who and what their children are spending their time with. Now, that is a lot harder now than it used to be. If I was running around with the wrong people, my father would just say, you don't need to be messing with them. Well, why is that? You know, they seem like good enough people. Nope. I've heard too many bad things about that. You need to stay away from them. You know, you don't have to say anything. You don't have to do anything. You just need to hang out with somebody else. Leave them alone. Don't mess with them. These days, you don't have to worry about just their friends. As a matter of fact, there's a good chance they don't even have any that they'll actually come into physical contact with. Nowadays, it's all screen time. They're on their phone. They're on their computer. They're talking with people that you don't even know. You don't even have any idea they exist. And what are they talking about? You don't know. You know, it's not been too terribly long ago. Some 13-year-old girl was going to go meet up with some guy. She didn't know he was 55. But she'd been online talking with the guy. Fathers need to control access to that kind of thing. You know, in Proverbs chapter 12, in verse 26, it says, the righteous should choose his friends carefully, for the way of the wicked leads them astray. And one of the things is, you are influenced by the people that you are around. It's really, really hard not to be. And we all have been to one extent or another. It's a sad thing, but if you've got a few years behind you, you can think back to the way things were. You know, you would watch television and, you know, they did not allow four-letter words. I mean, it was a national uproar when they had one in Gone with the Wind there at the very end. One word and everybody had a hizzy. I remember going to see the original King Kong and they wouldn't let me in, because it was a movie for mature audiences, because it was scary. And you know, some of the stuff that your children watch now is a whole lot scarier. And some of that stuff I won't watch. Scare me to death. I couldn't sleep. And kids watch it. We have gotten used to that. There are things that people are doing now on television, online, in movies, that if it had been done when I was a child, there wouldn't have been enough lampposts to hang them all from. Because that's what people would have done. They would have had a riot. How dare you put that filth in front of my children? You know, they would have been absolutely livid with anger. And nowadays, no big deal. Even us, we don't pay that much attention to it. It happens. Nobody thinks about it. Somebody says something about it, and it's, oh, yeah, you're right. That just went right past me. I didn't even pay any attention. You know, it's the old, you know, put the frog in the hot water, and he'll hop out. Put him in cool water and gradually raise the heat, and he'll sit there and boil to death and be happy as he can be because he doesn't notice. And that's what's been happening to us for a long time. 1 Corinthians chapter 15, 33, do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. It will do it. That's one of the reasons that God designed the local congregation the way he did. We get to have contact with good people. We don't have to be in contact with bad people all the time. We can come to services or spend time on a social level with the best people in the world, Christians. You know, who could ask for better than that? But fathers are supposed to teach their children. They're supposed to discipline their children. They are supposed to be the leader of the family in every possible way. Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, you fathers, do not provoke your children to wrath, but bring them up in the training and the admonition of the Lord. Teach them to be good people, good Christian people. If you do that, everything else falls naturally into line. If you can train your children to be good Christian people, they'll be a good husband or a good wife. They'll be a good father, a good mother. They'll be a good citizen. They'll be everything that we should be because you brought them up right. And that's one of the things, you know, you can tell about people a lot of the time. I've seen some people, and there was one youngster. I don't remember how old he was, but he was pretty young. And the way he addressed me and the way he acted around me, I told Marcia, I said, you can tell that kid was raised right. He was polite. He recognized his place. He didn't act out in any way. You know, children are going to be children, and that's part of it. You know, parents realize that. They make exceptions or make allowances for that. But there are certain things that you shouldn't do, you know. And he said, please and thank you. He said, sir and ma'am. And I thought, wow, boy, that's unusual these days. That was a kid that was raised right. And unfortunately, sometimes that's the exception, not the rule. Fathers, to an extent, have abdicated their position in the family, and that is what is causing a lot of our problems in society today. Fathers are not at home being fathers, and they should be. Luckily, Christians still recognize that they have that God-given responsibility, and they will try and fail sometimes. We're all imperfect, but they will do their best to take care of their family, both materially and spiritually, and they will provide for the training of their family, as God has said they should. It may be that there's someone here this morning that's not a child of God. If you're here and you're not a Christian, God, through his grace and mercy, has given you another opportunity to be obedient to the gospel of Christ. You could come forward this morning confessing your faith in Jesus as the Son of God, and you could be baptized to have your sins washed away. If you're an erring child of God, then you need to go to God in prayer, confess your sin to him from a repentant heart, and ask him to forgive you, and he's promised to do that. Or it may be that you're here and you just need the prayers of those that are gathered here for some other reason. Whatever your need is, would you come forward and make it known while together we stand and sing.